Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We are joined this hour, the entire hour, with Dietrich Mohammed, Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies. That's a mouthful. And also co-founder of the Race and Economic Policy Forum. Dietrich, good to have you co-hosting today.
On the birthday of Malcolm X. Look forward to discussion.
And that's what we'll be doing today, talking about Malcolm X during the course of this entire hour. We'll be joined during the course of the hour by Minister Akbar Mohammed, who served under Malcolm X in the Nation of Islam. He also worked closely with Minister Louis Farrakhan and Imam W.D. Mohammed. Hopefully Amina Wadud will be joining us as well. She's an Islamic feminist and scholar. Her most recent book is Inside the Gender Jihad, Women's Reform in Islam, one of the leading Islamic women thinkers on the planet, who was on our show about 4 years ago, so it'd be good to have her back. Then later in the program, we're going to be joined by Omari Musa, who's a member of the Socialist Workers Party, the one group on the left that Malcolm X really talked with and read, the militant, in his time.
And a group that really helped compile some of his speeches and distribute those speeches.
Right. And one of those men who lives in Baltimore now, Baxter Smith, who was put with George Brightman those speeches together and has written some good stuff on him. And we'll also be joined by Lily Clarkson, who's a member of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement in Brooklyn. That's in the second half an hour of the show. And right now we're going to hear an interview that I did this morning with Ilyasa Shabazz, who is the daughter, one of the daughters of Malcolm X, who's putting a new foreword together for the new edition of the autobiography of Malcolm X, and was a guest in the show 7 years ago when we interviewed her along with the daughter of Ralph Abernathy and a number of others. Mm. We did a program with the children of civil rights leaders. But she joins us today to reflect on her father. We talked this morning around 10 o'clock or so this morning and recorded this interview for all of you. So we bring you the interview we did this morning with Ilyasa Shabazz now. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We're about to have a conversation with Ilyasa Shabazz, who is the daughter of Malcolm X on this day, when he would have been 85 years old. And Ilyasa, so welcome. Good to have you with us once again after 7 years.
I tell you, time flies, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
It really does. And what does it say? It says that we should continue for self-improvement, because before you know it, all this time has passed, and if we at least achieve something, if we could give something back in that time frame, mm-hmm. then we're doing good.
I agree. And also the time thing makes me think of something that you know, whenever somebody of greatness dies in our midst, like your father did, who was taken away so early, we freeze that person in time as if they would never have grown from that moment. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, I do.
And it's frustrating because people then can manipulate and use the image for anything they want to, for their own benefit.
I think that speaks to the chapters that were removed from the autobiography. Attorney Gregory Reed, he acquired the manuscript, the original manuscript, and chapters, the outline for the autobiography, and they took those chapters out and basically defined Malcolm for us. And the beauty is that with all this information on the internet, with again study, we are able to see Malcolm for who he really was, and a compassionate young person who dedicated himself to the struggle for justice. Despite race, creed, gender, he dedicated all of himself.
So I the last time we spoke 7 years ago, you said a couple of things that really struck me, and one was you told us this description of the father you remember and his coming home and how excited you all were when he walked through the door and picking you up and eating these oatmeal cookies that your mother made. And that image of Malcolm X is something that goes missing because of all the politics sometimes.
Right. My father, he was just a man in his 20s when the world learned of him, when he committed himself to social justice. And, my own premise is that every child should have an opportunity to feel good about him or herself.
Mm-hmm.
That despite one's socioeconomic status, race, gender, or creed, that every parent, no matter where you go in the world, it seems that every parent or guardian wants for their children a quality education, an environment conducive for growth, an environment conducive for a healthy identity formation. And so my parents were no different. And what a lot of people don't understand is that Malcolm's parents were no different, because they were the ones who prepared him to be the Malcolm X that we know. They, back in the 1920s, they were members of the Garvey movement. There were 3 million, at least 3 million African American followers, and my grandparents, Malcolm's mother and father, played pivotal roles in that organization. His mother was a recording secretary, so my father saw her reading, studying, organizing. She was the one who encouraged her children to read the dictionary from beginning to end. Their father was a minister. He was an advocate for Garveyism. They believed in the brotherhood of man and the fatherhood of God, preserving their history, the importance of their history. And so a lot of people think when my father went to jail that he miraculously became this Malcolm X, when the truth is that his parents prepared him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his father was assassinated when he was gathering a petition.
Right.
To take the U.S. up on charges for violating the human rights of African Americans in the 1920s.
Right.
Okay, and so my father, 33 years later, would take the baton from his father. So a lot of people don't realize that, you know, he came from a family of humanitarians, of activists for social justice. So it was very easy for him to, well, you know, I shouldn't say it was easy for him, but he willingly gave of himself to these causes for justice for those suffering, for so many different reasons.
That's really an important thing to remember, I think.
Yeah.
And because people go through all kinds of their own personal changes during life and fall to the bottom, come back up. But a lot of the foundation was when they were young and their parents. And
right.
And this is an important point for us to remember, mm-hmm. I think, about your dad. And that, you know, I wondered what you think now about this where America is for you, this arc between the time of Malcolm and Martin to this moment where Barack Obama is president of the United States, and clearly there's a firmament of things changing once again. And I wonder how you view that arc between your father and where we are now.
Well, I think, again, that there are a lot of people who paved the way. I mean, we can go back 400 years, 300, 200, 1,000. I think that, with the works of and the persistence of our ancestors, that we're able to make great strides, but they're not great enough. You know, the work still continues. You know, there's still injustice around the world. There's still inequity around the world. And, you know, so we still have a job to do. And I think that it's a shared responsibility among each and every one of us. And, again, the reason that it's so important to prepare our children so that they can live more purpose-driven lives and that they are accurately informed of history.
And it's in this day, one final thing, I'm just curious about your own reflections. I mean, I know that all of us who have lost somebody mm-hmm. close, a parent, and then it's their birthday, and I think about that on my dad's birthday coming up, what you're reflecting on, how you're feeling about this moment. This got to be a heavy day for you.
I looked at my mother's life, and I learned that I did not want to be a victim to anything, and
mm-hmm.
my mother didn't live her life as a victim. Despite her witnessing her husband's assassination, despite all of the different man-made obstacles that she confronted, I think because she never accepted no or I can't as an answer, and she possessed self-respect, she understood history, that you know, she persevered and she triumphed. And so I try to look at my life and be grateful for all of the experiences and all of the things, you know, that I benefit from. You know, I'm happy and proud of my parents, and I'm grateful that they instilled the values that they did and that I, you know, and I'm just so happy and grateful for them that I really try not to become burdened by any of these things, because, you know, we can look at people all around the world who suffer in so many different ways, and then we can look at the joys of it. And I really, you know, I'm a person who looks at a glass half full than half empty.
Well, you carry on your own life independently, but you carry on the legacy of both your mother and father very beautifully. And Ilyasa Shabazz, it's been just a pleasure and honor to have you on the air with us once again, and have a peaceful
day. The pleasure is mine. And you still sound the same young, chipper self.
I try. I work at it. I try.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. It's been wonderful. Have a beautiful day.
Thank you. You do the same.
Take care. That was a conversation I had this morning with Ilyasa Shabazz, the daughter of Minister Malcolm X. We are joined now in studio, co-hosting with me the entire hour, Diedrich Muhammad, Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good for the Institute for Policy Studies, and also co-founder of the Race and Economic Policy Forum, who helped produce this hour and bring a number of our guests that we wanted to have on today on. One of those guests is Minister Akbar Muhammad, who served under Malcolm X in the Nation of Islam and has worked closely with both Minister Louis Farrakhan and Imam W.D. Muhammad. And Minister Akbar Muhammad, welcome. Good to have you with us.
On this day, as you talk about the life of Malcolm.
It's great to have you on the air with us.
Assalamu alaikum, Minister Akbar.
Wa alaikum salam. How are you, my brother?
Very good. Good to hear your voice again.
And we hope that soon we'll be joined by Amina Wadud, who is scheduled to come on, but we're having a phone problem. If we can get through to her, we'll have her on. She is one of the world's leading Islamic feminists and scholars who wrote the book Inside the Gender Jihad, Women's Reform in Islam, and who clearly kind of blew our listeners away when she was on last time 4 years ago, and look forward to having her on again. Mr. Akbar, just to begin, I like to just start in a kind of very non-political way for a moment. And I'm curious about your reflections on Malcolm X. You've remained in the Nation of Islam. You're a minister there, in the nation, and served under Malcolm. And a lot has gone on the last 40 years since his assassination. And I wonder if maybe both of you come on, which is reflect a bit on the changes inside the nation when it comes to perceptions of Malcolm X, and how this conversation kind of internally has been carried on over these years. And I'd like to start with you, Minister Akbar, if we might.
Right. Well, again, thank you very much, Mark. Let me say this. For a long time, I did not talk about working under Malcolm, what I learned from him, because the pain of the rupture between him and the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and those of us who stayed with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And I would always say that the reason when Malcolm left, I was one of the first five that he started a ministry class in New York in 1963. It could have been late 62 and 63, and there were five brothers who joined the class. And Malcolm took time with us. And what I saw in him was his sincere desire to produce helpers for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. His love for the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is very clear at that time, even when he, in 59, before I became a Muslim, I joined in 1960, he was given a trip overseas to Saudi Arabia, and he visited a few other countries in that area. But he did not go to Mecca at that time. He went to Jeddah. And he told us many times that he didn't go to Mecca. He could have made Umrah. They were inviting him. And he said no, he wanted to wait until the Honorable Elijah Muhammad went to Mecca first, and he deferred to his leader. That takes tremendous strength. And the Muslims who are listening to this program, if you got as far as Jeddah and you were invited to go to Mecca, whether it was during time of Hajj or Umrah, you know, it's something that you wouldn't resist, but he did. The things that he taught us in the class, and some of them stick with me to this very day, and some of them I still use. And I was a very young student in the class, and I think that I was probably the youngest in the class, if I think back. There may have been a brother my age. I joined the nation when I was 18 years old, and this was a few years after that he started that class. And when we think of 85 years later, I often think many times, how would Malcolm handle the scene today and his maturity if God had blessed him to live this long, and in his wisdom, and because of the diet and the teaching of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he was very disciplined, I'm sure that at 85, if he lived this long, he would have his faculties and be able to think and guide young people and reflect on the hour. And I don't think that he would have been, there's a term that we use, is from the Quran, don't hamstring the she-camel. I don't think he would have been hamstrung to agitate or criticize the government of America, even though it has a black president, if there were needs that the black community still have and if there were challenges, as there are many challenges in our community today. I think that Malcolm would have been on point. He would have been proud of Barack Obama being in the White House, but we would still have to have those voices that agitate for justice for our people to solve the many social ills that we are challenged today in the black community. And another point that I wanted to make, you know, when Malcolm separated from the Nation of Islam, it was difficult for many of us, especially those who were ministers under him. But he would always say, regardless of what you see someone do or a person do, that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, you stick with him. And many of us, including Minister Louis Farrakhan and others, they stuck with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad because that's what Malcolm had pointed out. But he wrestled with something as he built his organization. The day that he separated from the Nation, March the 8th, 1964, he proclaimed that he was a Muslim. He still believed in the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and I believe that. But his political philosophy was black nationalism. But when he built the OAAU, there was an internal struggle that I had learned about in the last 10 years. I knew nothing about it at the time. And that internal struggle was many of those who gathered around him, Muslims and non-Muslims, some socialists, some activists, they felt that the organization of Afro-American Unity, as they called it at that time, the OAAU, was all that he needed. But Malcolm insisted that he have Muslim Mosque Incorporated. And there was a struggle about that within them in terms of their dialogue over whether he needed it. But Malcolm clearly said that we needed a spiritual base. And I respect and love him for that.
Minister Akbar.
Though he had the difference with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he knew that to build any organization, there should be a spiritual base, and he chose for that base Islam.
Minister Akbar, when did Malcolm start Muslim Mosque Incorporated? Was it much after he started building the Organization of African American Unity?
No, at the same time.
It was exact same time.
At the same time, yes. And they met in the old Teresa Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
The building is still there today.
In Harlem.
Yeah, and that's where they met, but it was at the same time, and that was the struggle. So he had Muslim Mosque Incorporated and the OAAU.
And this is one question I want to ask as someone who actually knew Malcolm is, you know, what do you feel are the differences and the similarities between the Malcolm you actually knew as a real person and then the kind of the Malcolm that's really in many ways a myth? And that's really the Malcolm I grew up under, you know, because I was born in 73. So I was born years after he was assassinated. And I fell in love with Malcolm, the myth, and I think even hopefully even more so the speeches and words that were left behind. But I'm, you know, interested to hear, you know, what someone who actually got to know Malcolm, the human being, what you felt the kind of differences were and the similarities between the Malcolm the myth and Malcolm the man.
Well, one of them, you know, when we celebrated the 40th anniversary of his tragic assassination, the New York Times described him as a civil rights leader.
Hmm.
That was the myth, Malcolm. Mm-hmm. And he was death on civil rights leaders. He said, we need human rights in America. That's what we're suffering from, and that's what we should be fighting for, our human rights as human beings, to be respected and dignified as men and women who have suffered in America. So that's one of the myths, that he was a great civil rights leader. And another one of the myths is that, you know, on his first trip to Saudi Arabia, he saw some white Muslims. There's Muslims. When I was in Russia, I met many Caucasian Muslims and some of the finest Muslims. Or when I recently made a trip to Bosnia. And Malcolm was a brilliant man, self-taught. And he knew that there were white Muslims in the world. The myth is that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad made him and us believe that the only Muslims were black Muslims or dark Muslims, and he went to Mecca and saw some white people who were Muslims, and it was an eye-opener to him. That is a myth.
And that would have been pretty difficult for someone in Malcolm's position to believe in the first place, since he was in New York City. He was hanging out at the United Nations, where I'm sure he probably, even in New York, at the United Nations, he must have bumped into lighter-skinned Muslims.
But I may ask a question about that, all due respect. I mean, I've having heard Malcolm speak in my younger days and read all of his speeches, I remember when he made that speech, and it wasn't quite saying that this was the first time that he heard of white or Caucasian Muslims, but that something of an epiphanal nature happened for him, and that he came back to America. And there's a lot of talk about part of that epiphanal nature is what one of the things that led him to being killed. I mean, to being assassinated. That his assassination. I mean, you knew that the FBI in America, under J. Edgar Hoover, was terrified about the idea that he would reach out across racial lines, that he would reach out across to Reverend Martin Luther King, that these things were terrifying to people in power, because in some circles of power, they felt much more comfortable with the idea of Malcolm X being in a Nation of Islam, which the popular wisdom was, speaking just to black folks who would join NOI, and he became much more dangerous there. But I remember that speech he gave where he very clearly stated that something happened to him. He began to see things that way in a different light than he had before. Are you suggesting that didn't take place?
No, what I'm suggesting is that, you know, Malcolm used to say this to us all the time, traveling broadens one's scope. But what the myth that I'm saying is that he had this great awakening because he saw some white Muslims in Mecca.
Which is
the myth.
Which
Malcolm knew that the awakening was that he had went and made the Hajj in Mecca, and he prayed with people of every color. And he had an awakening, but the awakening didn't make Malcolm came back and preach integration and preach that there's white people who are different because I went to Mecca and I saw some. He said that maybe Islam could change some of the attitudes in America of these people who were really racist to the core. And so the myth is, I want to make this clear, mm-hmm. The myth is that Malcolm went to Mecca. He didn't know that there were white people who were Muslims, and he came back and he changed completely in terms of his attitude towards white people.
And that myth doesn't derive from Malcolm's speeches, to my knowledge. That myth derives from Alex Haley's autobiography, which I think people have questioned. Malcolm did write a message about an epiphany, but I believe it was within the autobiography of Malcolm X that Alex Haley wrote, where he described the idea that the people in the nation didn't know that there were white Muslims, and that when Malcolm traveled to Mecca, that was the first time. I mean, like, I think so. I think there's a distinction there between Malcolm's maybe religious feelings that he had by actually doing the pilgrimage, and the idea that he was clueless that the Islamic world was a multicultural, multiracial world religion.
So a question, as we have some time here before we meet our next guest, is that I wonder if there's been some growth for a lot of people in America around the legacy of Malcolm X, whether it's inside the Nation of Islam or outside. Because everybody, when someone dies like that, is assassinated like that, in a culture like ours, the capitalist culture like ours,
yes,
then so the legacy becomes marketable. People start, everyone wants to own Malcolm X now.
That's right. I almost fell over when I saw Bill Clinton going on a jogging trip and he had a Malcolm X cap on. And I was just, you know, I was just amazed at that, you know.
Right. I want to make a point about that is that in Malcolm's death, the way that Malcolm was held up and championed, of course, there's been a change in the Nation of Islam in terms of the attitude towards Malcolm. And one thing that I hope that they will release the film, two things. One is the film made at New York University on the 40th year of the anniversary of his tragic assassination, where James 67X, and I can't think of his Muslim name, I think it's Rafiq.
Yes, Rafiq, right.
Rafiq,
yep.
Who was my lieutenant in the nation. We came in about at the same time. He came in, I think, a little even after me. But he stood on that podium that day and said that it's no way, you know, the three men that were convicted,
right.
Two of them were completely innocent. And these were two of my friends, and we worked together, Norman and Thomas, Muhammad Aziz and Khalil Islam, who passed away. The third man that was convicted was absolutely guilty, and they just released him. But he said on that podium that day, there were four speakers, myself, James 67, Benjamin, Lonnie Shabazz 5, and Hannibal Omar, who passed away also. Benjamin has passed away. And he said there's no way that we would let two active lieutenants in the March number 7, because of the level of the hostility, come in and take a seat on the first row. He said it could never have happened. And he told me when I met with him in Guyana, when he was living there with Herman Ferguson and a group of black Americans, he said the boss, Bureau of Special Services from New York City, filmed. There was a Gene 4X who was in the mosque with us, who was an agent from BOSS, it was called Bureau of Special Services, of the New York Police Department. They had a lot of plants inside of the mosque, the Nation of Islam mosque in New York. And he said to me that that day was filmed, and probably after 50 years, that film will probably be released. It was Consular who went after
yes.
this tremendously. I just wanted to make that point, because the way that they have taken Malcolm on a postal stamp, and the
right.
and the introduction to the reprint of his autobiography, and they talk in detail about Mike Wallace and the postage stamp, because you can take the image of an individual. Malcolm challenged America on every level. He challenged the Zionism, which they don't bring up at all. He challenged the corruption within the political system when it came to black people who aspired for political positions but were completely locked out. He challenged the church and the responsibility of the church. He challenged the amount of drugs that were in the black community, and we saw a repeat of it with crack cocaine being brought in from Nicaragua through the CIA trying to fight the Sandinistas using the Contras. Malcolm challenged all of that, and if these activities were going on at that time and we have a repeat performance, would Malcolm be silent today and say everything is all right because we have a black man in the White House? So I just wanted to say Malcolm has inspired a lot of young people. And I know our time is limited, but I just want to make this point.
Mm-hmm.
I've been blessed to travel throughout the world, and one of the countries that I went was New Zealand. And the problem of the Maoris in New Zealand
yes.
is tremendous, between alcohol, sniffing of glue for the teenagers,
right.
and drugs, and the prisons are locked up. I did a radio show in New Zealand, and the lawyer there, a Maori lawyer who tries to defend these young men and women, said to me, I don't know what to do with them. He said, after reading Malcolm X's autobiography, the ones who were in prison, the only thing I would buy cases of them and go into prisons and give them out and tell them to read this, and maybe this will help you to reform your conduct and your way. And so I'm saying the impact of Malcolm worldwide has been tremendous. So to go back to my original point, yes, there's a change attitude inside of the Nation of Islam as it exists today under the Minister Farrakhan and others who proclaim the Nation of Islam, their attitude towards Malcolm is completely different.
Mr. Akbar, I want to say and I really do appreciate you being on this program, and I think we've all learned a great deal. And I think you, when we were talking earlier, you were talking Abdullah Razak. Abdullah Razak.
That's right.
And
thank you.
Who was underground and had to flee America, worried that the FBI was going to kill him after Malcolm X was assassinated, and with his brother and others moved to Guyana, and then goes back and forth now. He's back in the man in his 70s and
that's
comes
right.
to visit his son in Brooklyn often. The whole question of Malcolm's murder that day, about the police, about his bodyguard being left outside, about all the people trying to reopen the case, and what Manning Marable, a professor at Columbia, is leading the charge to reopen the case, to have an investigation to find out exactly what happened that day, so it's not left to the ethers for all these rumors about what actually happened and why Malcolm X was assassinated. So you've enlightened us a great deal, Mr. Akbar Muhammad, and I'd appreciate it if one day we get you back and we could have a wide-ranging discussion for an hour just on where the Nation of Islam is today.
Yes, and thank you very much. And Manny's book will be out this year, God willing. You know he's been pretty sick. But it's an excellent reflection of Malcolm inside of the Nation of Islam that he focused on. I have a large interview within the book where he talked to me about it. But I hope that his book will be out this year. It's nearly 1,400 pages.
Looking forward to that.
Thank you. Thank you again for having me.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Akbar. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Alaikum salam. Minister Akbar Muhammad, who served under Malcolm X in the Nation of Islam and also worked closely with Minister Louis Farrakhan and Imam W.D. Muhammad. When we return, Dietrich Muhammad and I will be joined by Omara Musa and Lalit Clarkson. Lalit Clarkson, part of the Malcolm X grassroots movement in Brooklyn, and Omara Musa, a member of the Socialist Workers' Party. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us. By the way, the lines are open, 410-319-8888. Bring us your reflections on Malcolm X. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. I'm co-hosting today with my friend and colleague, Dietrich Muhammad.
Yes, sir. Good to be on.
Senior Organizer and Research Associate for the Program on the Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies and co-founder of the Race and Economic Policy Forum. I want to remind you all the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenebaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure of cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org or call 1-800-888-8823. Dietrich and I are now joined by Omari Musa, who's a member of the Socialist Workers' Party, and Lalit Clarkson, member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement in Brooklyn. And gentlemen, welcome. Good to have you both with us. Got you there? Hi. Lalit and Omari, welcome.
Yes, we're both here. I'm here.
Good, good. 410-319-8888. And Emily is the first caller up. We're going to go to her in just a minute, but I want to let our guests talk a bit about what you both think, and two different perspectives here. Lalit, from the perspective of a younger person, 26 years old, a member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, I'd like you to reflect a moment on as a 26-year-old activist, the relevance of Malcolm X in your life and the life of our nation today.
And
Dietrich, go ahead.
And Lalit, I'd also like you to just mention briefly, you know, what is the Malcolm X grassroots movement, and why is there still an organization that carries Malcolm's name, and how they see themselves associated with Malcolm X?
Okay, no problem. So in terms of what is the Malcolm X grassroots movement, it's the organization of people of African descent, also known as New Africans, Black folk, Afro-Americans, that basically do three things. One, build institutions in our community by us for us, promote self-determination, and defend the human rights of African people within the empire and across the world. So I guess that's sort of, you know, just kind of really what our charges are. And in terms of why carrying the name Malcolm X, and yes, in terms of my reflection, for us it kind of breaks down into three pieces. One, self-determination. Two, self-defense, and three, self-respect. And I think for myself as an organizer, And for someone within the Malcolm X grassroots movement, those three pieces are what carries us through our work. The need for, you know, African people here within the empire and globally to be able to work in the interest of African people, in their best interest, on one hand. On the other hand, the ability to defend ourselves against, you know, attacks from other communities and from our own communities as well. And the two of those pieces leading to self-respect, you know, under this sort of system that we've been colonized and subjugated under, self-respect factor always becomes problematic in terms of how we move as a people. So for myself, you know, personally, in terms of how Malcolm influences me, I think, you know, again, those three pieces, you know, Malcolm's, you know, consistent talk about self-determination, the need for African people to organize on behalf of African people, self-defense, the understanding that we as a community must defend that which we create, and self-respect, again, the understanding that, you know, the understanding that those two pieces cannot come into fruition until, you know, we are able to respect ourselves wholly as human beings.
And actually, if I could do one follow-up question real quick. I would also like to ask, because, you know, I'm slightly older than you, a little over 10 years older than you. And when I was growing up, like I said, I only knew really the legacy of Malcolm X. And it was like it was religious, but it was also a political, radical legacy that was reinforced by a lot of activists and a lot of hip-hop music at that time, whether it was Public Enemy or KRS-One or various different groups of a kind of a black radical militancy. Today, you don't seem to have that in the same fashion as in the past. And I'm wondering what you feel that the youth of today, 20s, teens, how they look at Malcolm X, if they look at Malcolm X, and what's the future for the legacy of Malcolm X?
I mean, I think in some ways, and again, even though you don't necessarily hear Malcolm in the sort of political conscious hip hop, you hear, unfortunately, the image of Malcolm by any means necessary utilized by 50 Cent.
Hmm.
You see the images of a black man holding a gun by the window in when you're talking about Lil Wayne and other sort of individuals. So I think that for younger folks, the legacy is still there, even if we're not necessarily out in front with it. Folks still understand, okay, by any means necessary. Now, the unfortunate part is that a lot of young folks take by any means necessary, you know, to mean how I'm going to make capitalism work for me.
That's,
or, you know,
they have very different, you know, ends, right, to their means.
So I think, you know, again, it's impingent, particularly upon, you know, those that are my age to continue to move the legacy, not just through name only, but through work. So what does self-determination look like? What does self-defense look like? How can we benefit that to the community? And I also think New York has particularly been good. You know, today would have been the 85th birthday, the Hajj al-Malik Shabazz, of doing visits and programs to the grave site, where you have three generations. I was actually there this morning, where you have elders, you know, people like Dr. Ben, who's an elder. You know, you have folks in their 40s, folks in their 30s. There's always babies there. And then there's a march across 125th Street, in which the stores closed down for 3 hours. So I know particularly in the village of Harlem in particular, you know, young folks, at least on today, you know, it becomes, all right, so who is this Malcolm X dude? Because I heard 50 Cent talk about him in a rhyme. I heard Lil Wayne talk about him.
Right.
So, you know, and again, because we take on that name for our movement, you know, based on self-determination, self-defense, and self-respect, the way that we move as an organization, you know, whether we're talking about political prisoners in hip-hop, whether we're talking about anti-police brutality, is always, you know, taking those three phrases in the way that we organize in our community.
Let me turn to Omari Musa. Omari, thank you for joining us and going back and forth and making time for us today.
It's my pleasure.
Talk a bit about your perspective on Malcolm X. And I know that one of the things I said at the very top of the hour, that the Socialist Workers Party, who publishes The Militant, still comes out, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Was the one paper I remember Malcolm X in the early 60s holding up.
In addition to Muhammad Speaks.
In addition to Muhammad Speaks. to Muhammad Speaks. Thank you, Diedrich. and I wonder, Omari, if you'll reflect a bit on what you think the legacy is of Malcolm X after on this 85th anniversary of his birth, and especially given the work that you do.
Well, the first thing I would do is urge your listeners very strongly to read a new book we put out called Malcolm X, Black Liberation and the Road to Workers' Power. The thesis of the book is going over part of the life of Malcolm X, but more importantly, the political development in his last year, which is not covered by most certainly the autobiography or Spike Lee's movie and many things that have come since then. Our opinion is that Malcolm had come to the conclusion that the system of capitalism, a world system, was the problem of black people and the oppressed all over the world, and that the system itself had to be overthrown internationally. The reason we publish his books is so that people can read his own words about what he said about this system. Malcolm was an internationalist. He was opposed to supporting either the Democratic or Republican parties or any of their offshoots. He thought that blacks in the United States had to organize ourselves to defend ourselves politically as well as any other way, and many others understood that. Robert F. Williams, for example, who was a leader of the NAACP in North Carolina, organized to defend the black community against racist assault. What we call for today is not so much people running around with guns. People have guns. That's not the problem. The problem is that people don't recognize the root of the problem. And the root of the problem is the capitalist system itself. Its mechanisms are automatic. It works as it works. There's no intervention, band-aids, or anything else that can solve the problem. The thing that I think is most important is Malcolm pointed to real revolutions that happened in the world. He supported the Cuban Revolution. That was not a nonviolent revolution. That was a revolution where the Cuban people were organized and took power away from the capitalists in Cuba and from the United States capitalists, and have suffered for 50 years under the hammer of blows from the United States for defending their sovereignty and their right to organize society as they would. He defended the Chinese Revolution. He defended the fight of the Vietnamese for liberation. And he was on the side of all of the liberation forces all over the world. And as he said, no matter what color, who are fighting against the common enemy.
Let me
all of our educational system either idolizes Malcolm, including things like postage stamps, TV shows, but none of them get to the real point. That is that the system itself is our problem. Has been our problem, and until we get rid of it, we will have the problem. It doesn't matter if there are black people in Congress. Doesn't matter if there's a president who's black. It doesn't matter if we support the lesser of two evils, we will still have the same system. So we are in a situation in the United States of solidarizing with people around the world and struggle as we did around things like African liberation days that were organized here in the United States and around the world. But now we have to understand that it is the capitalist system itself, which is an international system based in its strongest empire, the United States, that is the problem and has to be overthrown along with the other oppressed and exploited in the United States and around the world.
But Malcolm's analysis was also with capitalism, but also with white supremacy as well, right? Before, when he was in the Nation and after the Nation. So does that fit into the book that you've put out with Malcolm, about Malcolm, on this black liberation idea, the idea of where anti-white supremacy and anti-capitalism come together?
Well, the book that I mentioned, Malcolm X, Black Liberation and the Road to Workers' Power, takes up where Malcolm came from a street hustler, from the time even before that when his father was an activist and supporter of the Marcus Garvey movement. The attacks on his family, the hospitalization and jail of his mother all the way up until the last day of his life. We can't end Malcolm's political development before he actually is assassinated. We have to take it all the way up to the day. Just like everybody else, we aren't born one thing or another. We develop in the course of our fight, that is, as the oppressed, against the oppressor.
So you don't think that Malcolm still had a critique of white supremacy when he was killed?
No, I think Malcolm thought that the system itself, which is dominated in the United States by whites, not blacks. Most blacks are civil servants for those who rule us. But the system itself was the problem, and that is what we had to get rid of. And as he said, he was prepared to fight with anyone who was opposed to this system by any means necessary.
Yeah, but I guess I differ in that. I really do believe that he had a critique of white supremacy. And, I mean, many people who critique white supremacy and want to fight white supremacy are willing to fight with whites to end white supremacy. But, I think most people that I have read that look at Malcolm when he was in the Nation, before the Nation, after the Nation, would argue that he had a serious critique of white supremacy to the very day he died. And I would like to think he would still have that today, because I still see that as a serious problem.
I'm not disputing that. What I'm disputing is that, what I'm saying is that the system of white supremacy is integrally linked to the system of capitalism.
Yes, sir.
You can't get rid of one without the other. And that is the conclusion I think Malcolm came to.
Hmm.
Let me open
not
the phone.
He assuaged whether there was white supremacy or racism or not, but that the system itself bred it, kept it going, and used it to divide the oppressed and exploited in the United States and around the world.
I want to open the phone to let our listeners have the same reflections we've all talked about here. We're joined in the studio, of course, by Dietrich Muhammad, co-hosting here today on this 85th anniversary of the birth of Malcolm X. In the 45th year after his assassination. 410-319-8888. On the phone, you just heard Omari Musa, also joined by Lalit Clarkson, member of the Malcolm X grassroots movement in Brooklyn. 410-319-8888. Amelie in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Steiner.
Good evening.
Assalamu alaikum, guests.
Walaikum salam.
I'm enjoying your commentary on Brother Malcolm, and I wanted to make a comment that every year in Baltimore, there's an organization called the Soul School Institute, and we take what's called the Malcolm X Tour, which is a one-day trip to New York. On this day, there's a ceremony at the cemetery for Brother Malcolm and Sister Betty. It's a very solemn ceremony. It's always observed from above by helicopter. Of course, we take a trip to the Schomburg Institute, and we go to the ballroom that is now a museum for Malcolm. Beautiful statue of him at the correct height so you can stand next to this bronze statue and get the feel of what it would be like standing next to Malcolm, who was quite a tall man. But the comment that I wanted to make, brother, and I agree with you, is that because Malcolm had gotten to an international level and he was developing the Organization of African Unity and he was politically involved on an international level, he became such a threat to the United States. There's a brother that was on one of the tours that wrote a book about the conspiracy to assassinate Malcolm, and it shows that the guys that they arrested for that, the bullets came from a whole nother level.
Yes, we talked about that earlier. Yeah.
Okay, I missed that part. But anyway, he's right here in Baltimore also. He teaches at BCCC up here at Liberty, wrote the book. So keep on the good work, and I really am enjoying your program, Mr. Steiner. I wish that we still had our shining black prince, but we do have the analogy, his crystal clear analogy of how the world, the international politics, he really crystallized that for people of African descent in America.
Amelie,
thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's go to the next caller here real fast, and we'll come back to, I guess, 410-319-8888. Kevin and Woodlawn were on the air.
How you doing?
Hi, Kevin.
To your guests also. I just wanted to say real quick, I really think some of the nationalists, part of the nationalist movement today, I think some of it is a bit outdated in terms of the times right now. I really believe it's a time really to bring the races together. And I'm not saying reaching out to the far extremes of the white races. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is that, you know, I think we'll be on this whole separatist nationalist type of ideology. It hasn't gotten us anywhere thus far. And I think that, we're not going to make it as only roughly 10% of the population in this country anyway. By going in that direction, I think that there are good people of all races who are for human rights of all people, and I think that we kind of hurt ourselves when we still are living in somewhat of it. And I'm not, you know, don't take this personal. I'm not taking it a negative light. And kind of the dark ages of thinking, which was positive, which was good for its time, But right now, it's just, you know, it's just a whole nother day. And the reason, one of the reasons why we are now is just because of the separatism of both extremes, white and black. It's kind of gotten us in a situation because the average person just wants to exist in peace and live harmoniously, you know. And I think that some of the thinking, the nationalist thinking, I think is somewhat outdated. I think even Malcolm himself, when he took his pilgrimage to Hajj, saw people of all races.
Well, Kevin, we only have a few minutes left here, and so if I get our guests to kind of comment on that all very briefly, because we only have a few minutes before the top of the hour, Lalit, you want to start off, and then Omari very quickly, and then Diedrich.
I mean, I think two pieces very quickly on that piece. One, I think history has shown through white supremacy that the ruling class, white supremacists, whatever you want to call them, did not work in the interest of African people. And as the other brother was saying, that African people within the system, you know, are civil servants in some ways to the ruling class, I think, on one hand. On the other hand, the only piece where I would kind of disagree with the brother, though, is that, you know, I think part of it is that we see ourselves as American and not recognize ourselves as a nation. I think that, you know, when the Jews do it or when the Irish do it or when the Italians do it or when the Chinese do it, when other communities talk about organizing and self-determination of their community, even within this empire space, it's not a problem, and they're able to move forward and together as a community. And I think that, you know, historically, again, we've had, you know, individuals that have asserted that line, like, yo, we all American, we all good. But the reality is that our communities are still in the same shape that they were 80, 100 years ago. You know, the living conditions of our people are still the same. You know, in particular, folks have taken that line in terms of, you know, are we going to, you know, we're going to move through civil rights, we're going to get our rights, we're going to get our vote next. And all that did was maybe give some crumbs to some African people. But in terms of what's in the best interest of how we're working moving forward as African people, that's not, you know, a correct assertion at all.
I
understand what the brother is saying based on, like, oh, you know, all that nationalism thing. But the thing about it is we as African people, you know, we have a nationalist sentiment. Now, are we?
Lily, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. We really, literally have less than 2 minutes left for the top of the hour.
I apologize.
That's not, it's all right, man. But Omari, a very quick thought, and I want to get Diedrich in here too, so we don't have.
Well, here's the point. Brother Malik should understand. My name is Omari. I think that Malcolm was converging with the international workers' movement against capitalism and imperialism. I'm a communist. I think capitalism has to be overthrown worldwide. I think that the vanguard role of the African-American nationality in the United States from the Civil War till today points out that we will be in the vanguard of the overthrow of the beast. The problem we have is that we haven't absorbed these fundamental ideas of the fact that there is a class and race struggle that goes on intermittently at the same time, and that it's the capitalist class that keeps racism alive. And that's the only way that we can be free from racism.
And
we should unite with working people around the world to do that.
Diedrich, I'm sorry, I apologize. We're almost, really almost out of time here.
I first want to respond to what Sister Emily had said about, and want to let everybody know in Baltimore that there's going to be a continuing remembrance of Malcolm X tonight at 8 o'clock at Muhammad's Mosque number 6 at 3306 Garrison Boulevard, 3306 Garrison Boulevard in Baltimore, the legacy of Malcolm X 45 years later. There's so much to talk about Malcolm X, and I hope some people come out tonight to have further discussions on that, and they can just Google Muhammad Mosque number 6 if they need directions. But I think, you know, the last brother brought up so many points I really need a full hour to discuss, because I would think Malcolm today, and I know I would question, really, is the problem that too many of us are nationalists, or is the problem the same problem that Malcolm faced when he was alive, that under a guise of integration, we still are maintaining segregation, poverty, discrimination, and all of those things, not just by race, but also by class. So I think there's so many things to talk about, and I think we all need to talk much more about what is the living legacy of Malcolm X and what that means today in this Obama America. So hopefully we can have more discussions like this in the future.
We have to come back to this and do it again very soon. And Diedrich Muhammad, thanks for coming in here and helping us put the show together today.
Thank you. Greatly enjoyed it.
Omari Musa. Thank you so much.
Tell people where they can get this new book.
It'll be on our website.
Okay. pathfinderpress.com.
Well, pathfinderpress.com. And Lalit Clarkson, thank you so much for taking time with us today from New York.
No problem.
We've had an hour reflecting on Malcolm X here on the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA Baltimore. And we'll come right back. Stay with us.